Yeah, I think the first, like I mentioned, urban sprawl seems to be the most obvious, one of the most visible sources of environmental concern for people. The first big environmental movement in our country seemed to be roughly 100 years ago, the early naturalists trying to set aside lands. Yellowstone, Yosemite, the early national parks. Why did they set it aside? These are treasures that are too great to let be wrecked by development, by other things. We got to preserve them for posterity. So that was one of the first environmental movements. Certainly during the 1930s and so on, there was a whole lot of interest in soil conservation, water conservation in farm communities. In the 40s, especially during World War II, a ton of interest in recycling of metal, of tin, types of things for military purposes, of paper, of everything. And part of that early environmentalism, we can argue, isn't really all concern about the environment. It was financial. It was frugality. It was, we need these resources during the war for war purposes. But people were very frugal and so on. And again, like with the soil conservation efforts, it may not have been because we're concerned we're destroying the planet. Is we need to do this so we don't destroy our farm because we need the farm to produce more food. So the Dust Bowl and the soil conservation efforts it improved may not have been done for environmental reasons, but on the other hand, isn't that truly what environmental concern is? I mean, we realize we have to sustain what we're doing so we can be farming the land 10 years from now. We want to recycle our paper and our metal and everything else because we need that. It's valuable. It's important. In a sense, that is a very much an environmental concern, even if people in those days didn't talk about, we're doing this to protect our environment. They nevertheless were doing so. Then in the 60s and 70s, I think the modern environmental movement certainly picked up steam. Maybe it was Rachel Carson's Silent Spring and concern about these pesticides, the modern technologies of farming, and nobody raising questions about the safety of it. She starts raising questions, we ban DDT, and maybe that starts our movement into environmental protection. And certainly, at the same time, I remember as a little kid in school going in and seeing a presentation by Commonwealth Edison in Chicago on nuclear power and how this was the safe, new, clean environmental thing. And I suppose in some ways it's safe and clean. In other ways, we've got thousands and thousands of years to store immense quantity of waste that we don't have a clue how we're going to store it yet. And we keep saying, well, we're going to take care of that, new technologies, and they do come along the line, but the nuclear power industry's very close to 50 years old now, and we're not very close to finding any possible solution that preserves it for more than a few hundred years. If you talk about preserving waste for 10,000 years in a self-contained area, 10,000 years, we can't really conceive of what 10,000 years into the future is. So look 10,000 years back, I mean, that's all human history. It's pre-ancient Egyptian culture. Think how little we know about that. Think of trying to preserve something from then until now. That's what we're counting on, some way or another, finding interesting. So the environmental movement grew, and I remember 1970, April 22nd, I think, was Earth Day, and the environmental movement may have started with a small part of the 60s social activism movements, but I think it grew, and the larger population got involved, got concerned, and that was fed in the early 70s. By OPEC and the oil embargo. I remember one of the first chores I had as a new driver in the early 70s was to sit in line at gas stations because you had to wait on the days they had gas and you could do it. It didn't last too long, but think of how our habits have changed since that time. We were looking for smaller, more efficient cars. Now we're into the sport utility vehicle type of mode. But so I would suggest that in the early 70s, the environmental movement had its greatest urgency, and the public as a whole got, for the first time, really concerned, what are we doing to our planet? Well, we're 20 years later than that, 25 years later than that. I'd say the public concern is still there. It's still just as much. We gotta be concerned about posterity and what we're doing to the planet. But for a number of reasons I'll get into in a minute, I think we've lost the sense of urgency and the concern about how our personal behavior or our societal behavior impacts the environment. The mega macho sport utility vehicles, boy, they can. You look at the commercials for these things, and you could drive them up Railroad Creek easily, and you could drive them on a lot of the trails around here. If you didn't care about the environment, you could do that. These things are built to do that, so why do we need them on superhighways? It's sort of a macho image that's been created. They're beautiful vehicles that we want to have one. More power, boy, we need more power to go faster.
Even Cadillac makes one now.
Cadillac makes a sport utility
yeah,
vehicle?
So does Mercedes.
Yeah, I've seen Mercedes. It's the power, it's the status vehicle. And we're getting bigger and bigger, and certainly while technology makes engines able to be more efficient, we more than compensate the other way, and we consume a whole lot more energy than we did prior to our energy conservation era of the early 70s. And again, our society's behavior of packaging and waste producing is certainly seems less urgent. I think about the Twin Cities, how despite the fact that, and I don't know the number, but I will guess that looking at the curbside recycling in my neighborhood and other neighborhoods, where they pick it up every other week now, and they're making it easier and easier. Now you don't have to sort your metals from your plastics, from your glass. You just throw them in one bucket and you throw all the papers together in another one. I don't know how much of it gets recycled in the end that way, but a lot of it's collected that way. I would guess that people attempt to recycle a lot more, two or three times as much on average, maybe four or five times as much as they did 20 years ago, 25 years ago. But even after the recycling, we're still producing far more waste. I remember, well, you used to make soup on your own, then you got Campbell's soup and you'd put a can of water in with it, you'd get twice as much as you get in a can. Now you get the little individual serving packets, you know, soup and cracker packages wrapped in a can for one serving, and then it's shrink wrapped in another thing, and there's twice as much packaging as there is product in there. We're more concerned about it, but our behavior is making us less able to deal with it. So why the less urgent attitude, the less direct concern, the less thoughtful concern about it? I'd say some of them are changes in the economy and the political situation. End of OPEC and the oil shortage, gas prices fell, matter of fact, at they've been close to $1, $1.10 in Twin Cities area before I came here, and they say that is cheaper than gas was when it was 29 cents a gallon, 30 cents a gallon in the early 70s. Gas is cheaper, our energy is cheaper than ever, so the urgency of conserving it is less there. Certainly new technologies, and this is one thing I gotta say, is it should be a great sign for hope when we talk about environmental issues. I think it's more, business community saying don't worry about environment, to use this as an example, but I've often heard the example used, you know, if the naysayers and the environmentalists in New York City in the 1860s were saying, oh, if we don't do something about our problems, we're going to be buried feet deep in horse manure, and boy, new technologies took care of that problem, and yes, they do, and new technologies do take care of some problems. Maybe we'll find a way to deal with nuclear waste through new technologies. That's a gamble, but certainly new technologies make things easier. Telecommuting. You don't have to travel to work every day if you have laptop, computer, and fax and everything else. A lot of people work at home. There are lots of new technologies that give us hope, and along with that, maybe less urgent concern. I'd say the single biggest issue that's caused, or one of the biggest issues that's caused our lack of urgency is advertising and media. When I talked about the frugality and the financial caution in the 30s and so on, and recycling every little thing, I think of Connie's grandmother saving every plastic bag, reusing plastic bags. My mom used to save these margarine containers. We use them. We still use some of these things for cereal bowls 30 years later when we're camping. we saved plastic, and now everything's in plastic, and why would you save a plastic bag? But advertising has created the desire to consume. Public broadcasting did a series on a couple of things talking about our consumption. They talked about the word consumption used to be seen as a negative thing. Matter of fact, we call it a disease, consumption. Frugality is a good term. Nowadays, it's kind of consume, consume, consume. It drives the economy. It helps us all. We do more. The more you buy, the better off you
are. We are consumers.
We are consumers. And that's creative. They talk about how that's a phenomenon of the last 100 years, partly because it couldn't have happened before then. People didn't have the resources to consume that. We couldn't produce that much. Now we can. I keep thinking how when my father has probably 3 or 4 of his childhood toys, maybe 5 or 6, a good sturdy metal truck, a Lincoln log set, things like that. That was half of his toys in childhood. I mean, Depression era kids didn't have a lot of toys, and the 3 kids got 1 toy together. In our generation, you know, you get a toy or 2 at Christmas, and more than you needed, but you'd have them, and with a family of kids, you'd have a lot of toys over the years. Now, every time you go eat at a McDonald's, you get a toy. Every time you come visit somebody, you bring their kids toys, Beanie Babies. So our kids decided they had enough of them, and people still keep bringing them, you know? And we are able to produce more, and so somehow we desire more, we consume more. And so I think we've lost that spirit of frugality, of stewardship that I think we as Christians have a strong concern about. The next one of the big issues I would suggest that's changed our attitudes toward is the business community has in many ways co-opted the environmental protection issue for their own counter-offensive. Exxon Valdez, how many years ago is that? 12 years ago now, when the tanker ran aground and destroyed much of Prince William Sound. Instead of Exxon saying, boy, this is terrible, we're going to change our practices here, we're going to do this and do this and do this, they've done what they have to do, what government required them to do, paid the fines, made the changes in behavior. Some of them, go ahead.
They never paid their
fines. They haven't paid their fines.
Right, they only did the cleanup.
They're still fighting. Yeah, they cleaned up some of it.
Right, $5.5 billion of court-awarded fines are still.
And they're still, they fight it every step of the way. So what do they do instead? They go on the counter-offensive with media ads about how we care about the environment. Mm-hmm. Northern States Power, our biggest utility in Minnesota and Wisconsin, they run ads about NSP caring about the environment. You know, feel good about NSP, we're a good company, we do this. And I was going to say that a lot of the business hype seems to be plant a tree, recycle more, smile and repeat after me. I care about the environment. And it's kind of what's being taught in a lot of schools. You have more and more business-sponsored curriculum. I mean, I think it was in California a couple of years ago when the Dr. Seuss book, was it The Lorax?
The Lorax.
The Lorax, the one about the cutting of trees and so on, how the logging industry fought that because it was you know, communist-inspired book,
yeah,
kind of thing. It was very harmful.
What you could say about it.
It was teaching our kids that cutting down trees was a negative thing and we shouldn't teach that. I didn't know Dr. Seuss could be seen as, that's the way, in religious circles, Archbishop Dom Helder Câmara of Brazil said a number of years ago, when I work to feed the poor, they call me a saint. When I ask why people are poor, they call me a communist. And I was going to say, the same way the gospel can be a radical thing that scares people, Dr. Seuss, they were concerned he was teaching the wrong thing. And so much of it becomes, think how many businesses that may be some of the most polluting, least concerned about the environment businesses, do the most ads, telling people, you know, we're planting this many trees, we're doing this much to recycle. They're using green products to try and create a warm, friendly environmental image. And I would argue that that's their attempt to draw attention away from pollution, from overconsumption, from lack of sustainability in agriculture. They do it by doing, they read the polls. They know what the public's concerned about, so they hype it. But I think a lot of kids nowadays think the way to do it is to, let's go plant a tree and let's go recycle a little more and don't worry about pollution and other things. I think that the deadly environmental problems are the ones that are being washed under the, hidden under the carpet, washed away from public debate while they focus on that. And then the third one I was going to say that's happened, that's changed the lack of urgency in our society for addressing environmental concerns is also one from business community, financial interests, that has challenged the need to respond to the environment. They've challenged the problems directly. Global warming. Instead of saying, here's global warming, it's a climate change, it's very modest, but it's very modest global change, temperature changes can be devastating to the polar ice caps, to and therefore to a third of the U.S. population, which could go underwater, I suppose. But instead of discussing what we have to do about the problem, instead their direct challenge is to say, is it really a problem? There's scientific debate, is global warming a real problem? And there are plenty of scientists who say it's not really a problem. We're just in a long-term fluctuation slightly up there, and it's happened. Of course, global temperature fluctuations have occurred over the years. We have ice ages and warm periods, but our human life may not be able to exist as we know it in either of those extremes. Maybe we better be concerned about our shifting the environmental, the climate. But instead of what the problem is and how much of a problem and how urgently we have to address it, they instead tend to shift the debate to, is it a problem? And which country's fault is it? And how much should be our obligation versus the other country's obligation? And by doing so, they weaken our national or societal ability to respond to the problem. And I guess the thing I'd like to focus on for a minute on this last point is, think about it, you know, can we really afford to take a chance? When I mentioned earlier urban sprawl and how my colleague was saying, you know, this is our land, my constituents earned it, it's their money, it's their land, they can do whatever they want with it, without concern to the fact it's not their land. At least 200 years from now, I'd like to have them prove that it's Tom Johnson's land here. It's Tom Johnson's descendants' land, possibly, probably by then it's been sold 20 times. But we are making decisions for posterity, and on this issue, take global warming, which they're trying to say is not a problem. And I'm not a scientist, and I don't want to say how big the problem is or how small the problem is. It seems to me there's very credible evidence that the majority of the scientific community believes that we've got a very serious problem.
Overwhelming majority.
Yeah, and I can understand there's some who disagree, but even if it was half of them who said, you know, it's not a big problem, we don't have to be concerned, can we afford to take a chance with it? You know, this is the only planet we have to live on, and for our future, for 20, 30 years down the line, what does it mean? But again, that's a very selfish attitude in and of itself. What about our grandchildren and their grandchildren? Was it Chief Joseph who said that we should be concerned about the impact of all of our decisions seven generations down?
The sins of the fathers.
Yeah, where the political world thinks of long-term thinking as 2 years down the road.
Right.
Election time, usually, yes. And so I want to open this up for discussion in just a minute, but I want to get back to where we stand now with all this as a long, my sense of the history of the environmental issue in politics. I would argue that the public is well ahead of government on this issue. One of my colleagues who just left the legislature a number of months ago, strong environmentalist, proud to have received an Environmentalist of the Year award. He received it 1 year. He cares deeply about the environment. Every year he'd come to our political caucuses, our party organization in the Senate, and would talk about how, you know, we are wasting a great opportunity politically. And he was telling me he thought he couldn't sell it because it's the right thing to do. So sell it that politically it's a big winning issue. the public cares deeply about this issue. Why does the business community, instead of denying a problem, why does it turn itself around with ads saying, we care about the environment and you should too? Because they understand, they read the polls, they know where the public is, they see where the public is. And my colleague was telling his colleagues, why don't you guys recognize this? The public wants us to do something, they care about it. They'll vote for you because you do these things. Well, he never could quite win. Matter of fact, I would argue my party tends to be the more concerned about the environment, but we got the most anti-environment, environmental protection committee chair in one of the worst in the upper Midwest, I think, elected by my caucus and has been there for 10, 12 years. Anti-environmental protection guy that's our environment chair. Why don't people listen to my colleague about it? Well, because yesterday when I had a talk on stadiums, somebody made the point about the money in politics. Campaign money flows to those who don't speak out, and it actually flows against those who do speak out on the issue. And let me tell you, Exxon and business interests that want to ignore these problems for now, and think, if you think politics thinks short-term, business more and more thinks more and more short-term as well. And they're not that worried about what happens with Exxon 200 years from now. They're worried about what happens with it by the next quarterly financial report. And they do invest in politics. And it's not like one business, it's not like one villainous business, but they put a lot of money into the political system. And so people respond accordingly. And it is tough to get people to speak up. My first year in office, after 1 year, one assistant to another senator said how she had heard from again, Northern States Power, a big utility, this cheap lobbyist, that they were going to give me another year, another chance, otherwise they're going to start actively searching out somebody to run against me. If they were looking for somebody to run against me, they didn't do a very good job, but they were concerned that I was speaking out about these issues. They're more comfortable if you don't. And they will run somebody against you. They will look for money to spend against you. I mean, they have money. They can find ways to get to spend against you. And if you're favorable to them, they'll do it. So in the same way this issue came out with the stadiums, it comes out in environmental politics. And so I guess when you look at all these issues, I think we have to find a way to, we have to do several things in order to get this. First, we have to fight the Madison Avenue advertising world, our consume. We have to move away from that. The old concept of frugality is very important. We've got to regain that. We shouldn't be feeling bad. Again, here's business co-opting everything. In the 60s, remember when countercultural people started wearing jeans with holes in them and faded jeans and so on? To stand out, we weren't going to consume, get the newest, latest of everything. So what's the business community do? Let's sell pre-faded, pre-washed, right. Yeah. Pre-everything jeans. And don't be a conformist. How many brand names? Don't be a conformist. Be different. Stand out. Speak for yourself. And that means wear my advertising logo on the front Nike or for whatever company. We're going to sell that. You're going to be an individual if you dress like everybody else, and you better do that to fit in. They co-opted even that. But our personal lifestyle, we coming here to Holden, we learn a lot about it. It refreshes, renews our minds thinking about this. But we can serve as a model for others. We can serve as witness to society and how we ought to be. Maybe we don't need more things at Christmas or in between. We can't wait for Christmas or birthdays anymore for kids. We give them presents whenever they want. But our personal lifestyle is a witness. We can promote environmental political pressure, fighting big money, making sure people have an honest and sincere approach to politics, not, I think Ronald Reagan mastered the art of the media, where don't worry if you put James Watt in charge of Department of Interior and he wants to pillage our national parks, just go there and have lots of TV commercials with trees in the background and talk about the environment. You can get past it. Well, we have to promote an environmental political pressure that looks at the sincerity on the issue and the real approach to it. Then we have to work at education. and I would argue education not controlled by corporate sponsorship, to make sure we talk about what are the most serious problems. Is it that we don't recycle enough, or is it that we create a system in which we produce more and more and more waste? And then finally, and this may be one of the biggest issues, but I'm going to just mention it here, and that is population growth. I remember in 1970, about 1970, when they said population of the world was reaching 3 billion people, and by the year 2000 it would reach, at current plan, 6 billion people. It would double. And, you know, I think I heard recently that this year, this month or so, last month, we were reaching 6 billionth human being, and boy, that's awfully close in projections by ever who made it. And I remember in 1974, as a freshman in college, the biologist Garrett Hardin, who preached a pretty un-Christian ethic about lifeboat ethics, the world couldn't sustain the 3.5 billion people we had, and therefore we better push the other people into the ocean, let them starve to death, because with the lifeboat planet we're on, we couldn't sustain that many lives. Well, clearly we now have 6 billion people, and we're still have about the same number who are on the edge, who can't quite make it. I have a feeling current growth rates, we're going to have 10 billion people in another 25 years, and probably 1 or 2 billion of them will be suffering on the edge of starvation. So controlling the population just for sheer consumption of our resources and sheer pressure on the environment is going to be a big one that has to fit in with this. I talked a little longer than I wanted. I wanted to leave about half the time today for a discussion. But I hope that, I'm not sure which way you want to go with this, but I hope I've laid out a good framework to discuss. Yes?
Timber Industries, Weyerhaeuser, got rid of their biggest competitor, U.S. Forest Service. So they're laughing all the way to the bank. Another item is very few loggers cut trees. Landowners are the ones, and you never hear about the landowners doing the logging, the devastation. It's always loggers.
They're the ones driving the truck.
Yeah, they're the ones out there with the chainsaw, the logger is. That's the bad boy.
Drives the big machine that cuts a tree down and lays it down, limbs it, and puts it on the truck.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say that in terms of your comment about Weyerhaeuser getting rid of its competitors, I mean, that's the nature of our economy is such that we're mega mergers in every field are happening that way. And again, you know, if government provided the right incentives, we could turn around a lot of that, but government putting in logging roads at less than cost.
Fire roads.
Fire roads. They exempted Washington State and Alaska, I think, didn't they? When they said they had to stop building so many of those roads.
I'm not involved in the intimate details of federal policy, and I was going to say that companies tend to, we get fewer and fewer companies controlling more and more of industries, and they have more and more political clout.
And there's more corporate welfare, and they get special tax advantages on their property taxes because it's classified as forest land, even when they turn around and then finally sell it for development.
Yeah, and I do notice in Minnesota the timber debates always become, well, we're planting more trees than we're cutting, and that's definitely the case, but we are having a lot of aspen growth and a lot of hardwoods and other things. The diversity of the forest, biodiversity,
is... A tree like this and putting a tree like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, they may plant 20 times as many, but biodiversity is going out the window, which should be a concern. I was going to say, more than in our country, the tropical rainforest, when you talk about the medical community, talk about how many medical cures they think they want to try and preserve as many things just for pure medicine reasons, and how fast we're losing species of plant and animal life in rainforests. It's pretty frightening.
Can I switch?
Yes, and then over there next. Go ahead.
Water, H2O in all of its forms. Now, I don't know, but will there ever be more or less of it on this earth?
I don't think you can get more or less on the earth.
Is it always going to be the same?
Well, I think it's
Yeah. I mean, either we have a fixed amount. Again, you can convert it into hydrogen and oxygen, but I don't know that. I mean, we have a certain amount in the polar ice caps, we have a certain amount in the atmosphere, a certain amount in the oceans.
The lakes,
and basically, and a certain amount in groundwater.
It's not always where we want it.
Sometimes
it's salty.
And we have trouble with the fresh water, the non-salt water. We have problems with that. I was going to say some of the things, aquifers, underground aquifers, speaking from Minnesota example, I know we are some of the deeper down pure groundwater, we are consuming it much faster than it regenerates. Higher levels of groundwater do replenish a lot quicker, but and we've recognized the loss of wetlands is causing a big problem with restoration of that too.
But the water is still here. It isn't going anyplace.
Right.
So when we talk about the ecology of water, I mean, I always had that problem, you know. They say, well, we're overusing it, you know, and I'm wondering, how can you overuse
it? You can overuse certain types of it. I mean, overusing the groundwater, you drain that long term, you're going to have a lot of problems. I was going to say some of the sinkholes in roads in Florida have become from draining water underground.
Only that, an issue in Florida is they're pumping waste into the Laura aquifers.
Right. Pumping waste?
Pumping waste into the Laura aquifers.
They do that in Alaska.
To dispose of it. And they have no knowledge of what will happen in the long run. It could pollute the deep aquifers and destroy that water.
Jill Whitman's talk last week about surface water particularly, and saying, you know, it obviously has some unknown impact on groundwater. You can't clean out those. Those have been one of nature's best cleaners. I mean, that's how we get rid of our sewage here. We filter it into the earth, and earth breaks it down and makes it pure. So, no, I think we should be very concerned about certain types of water use. I mean, taking water out of the ocean and removing salt from it and using it, that's virtually unlimited supply of it, but contaminating the oceans or contaminating water supply. We have a lot of problems with contaminated wells in Minnesota, even though I think we've made great progress in addressing that. Capping old wells under houses, trying to control pesticide use near open water places.
Around the salt water, when you drill a well and you suck it out too fast, the fresh water, the salt water comes in. Soon you got salt water in your well now.
Jill was talking about that last week. Along coastal areas, when you drain out groundwater, you get salt water infiltration. Over there.
I'd like to ask you to speak from your own background, which is, I gather, in politics. What you see is, you know, if there's a consensus on accepting the goals of sustainability, could you talk a little bit about strategies? It's hard to preach about the evils of capitalism at a time when the environmental disasters of communism have become all too evident, and it's hard to talk about scarcity and the need for sustainability there at a time of great economic prosperity. So the question is, what are the kinds of levers that you can use to counter this bland nothing message and energize people to start working on issues for which the urgency seems to have receded? As a politician, how would you go about raising people's energy and positive solutions?
It's a good question, because there is no political debate over it. When I talk about long-term thinking in politics, is about 2 years down the road. It's amazing to get to the issue of one issue for a second, for perhaps partly illustration of your question. The Metropolitan Council, which was created in the late 60s in the Twin Cities area, was one of the most thoughtful, far-reaching, we're going to plan as a community, not as 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 suburban and city communities, but we're going to plan as a metropolitan area. One of the issues was land use. And so they've been around for 30 years now. I don't know, it hasn't been stopping the sprawl, it may be regulating the sprawl, but they say, okay, well, you can expand this development this many acres, you gotta get permission for each step of the way, and they're just sort of letting it trickle on out, and and has it slowed it down? We're one of the fastest sprawling areas in the country. We pay a little bit of lip service too, but very little action on it. And if I try and raise questions about 20 years down the line about the issues that I've been trying to raise today at the legislature, it's kind of, yeah, it's, there's no crisis right now. So how do you...
That was my question.
Your question, how do you create the attitude, the urgency, the need to respond without making an artificial crisis or stepping up the crisis? And that's the $64,000 question. I think one of the things you do is we keep working. Isn't one of the things I like about Holden? It gives us an example, a model that makes us think about it. I think the more we can do thinking about this, the more we can be concerned ourselves, the more we can work together with others who share the concern. We've had people speaking last week and this week on community organizing. There clearly are, if I tried to name all the environmental organizations in the Twin Cities interested in these issues, I could go through quite a few of them, none of which have a lot of power or massive membership, a lot of whom have a lot of public opinion behind them. How do we move that one step? I think it's partly education. I think at the political level, if you get a handful of people who will speak out aggressively on it, provide some leadership, I think the public will follow. It would help greatly if you have a U.S. president, if you have a governor of a state, if you have an executive, somebody who's got the visibility, who has the bully pulpit to talk about it. You know, go back, 25 years now to Jimmy Carter? Is it that long ago? 20-some years ago to Jimmy Carter, putting on the sweater in the Oval Office, and other than the fact that a lot of it was kind of a defeatist kind of thing, the malaise speech was from that time and so on. But the public, I think, was hungering then as it is now for leadership on the issue. And when he said, we're gonna have to sacrifice, I think the public was with him. I think the public kind of lost it when he said, what I mean by sacrifice, this is 25-year-old memory, but I'm thinking he said, well, put on a sweater, turn down your thermometer a few degrees, and say, I will consume less energy 10 times. It was kind of, he had a lot of, we ought to be concerned. He talked about the concern that I think the public had, but he didn't give them any concrete steps, and therefore, or nothing more than be concerned, and therefore, he didn't step forward with the leadership. And in the same sense, I don't want to be telling you, oh yeah, let's be concerned about them, what do we do? And I'm telling you, I don't know. But in a sense, I can tell you public policy-wise, I'm planning to drop in a bill next year, one small area, two-cycle engines. Why are we producing more two-cycle engines? I saw a story from California, I think it was San Francisco area, some group took a two-cycle outboard and a four-cycle outboard and put them in a bin, about 200-gallon bin of water, ran them for 2 hours. One of them they dumped back into the bay, the four-cycle one, it looked pretty clean water, about as clean as the bay was. And the other one, they were told if they dumped it in the water, they're gonna fine them for pollution. It was toxic waste. In 2 hours, 200 gallons of water, they said you can't dump that. Well, if you ran the outboard in the bay for 2 hours, you would have had the same impact, but you diluted enough and nobody pays attention. I'm trying a bill that Isaac Walton League is pushing, things like this nationally, to try and say, at least let's stop making new two-cycle engines. Let's set a date. If you have to give companies 2 years to get out of it, using a lawnmower for 1 hour is the same as driving a car how many hundreds of miles in terms of pollution? At least try that. I think one of the problems we in the political side of this area have been is we've been way too timid, because I used the line against NSP a few years ago, the best defense is a good offense. The business community has been on the offensive trying to weaken our laws. I think if we have some leadership that puts those things out, I think the public will rally, because the public does support them.
Even business will rally if they're forced to. When they order something to come up to Holden, mm-hmm. they tell them, do not pack it in those, what we call angel poop. The plastic peanuts.
Yeah, the peanuts.
They tell them not to send it up there. And for a while, I don't know if they still do that, but if they did send it up here, they sent it back.
Unopened.
Unopened. And they, if they opened it and they saw those, they closed it and sent it back, said,
you
send it
message.
To us in something that we can recycle.
In the business community, and the way that I told you how many parts of it, and I don't mean to suggest the entire business community is co-opting it for negative reasons. Some of them have really changed practices dramatically. When Honda shows its new cars and say how little they pollute and how, not just the good mileage, but how clean they are, hey, we ought to applaud them. Too many times we have to bring the auto industry and so on kicking and screaming to pay attention to these things, and they protest, we can't do it, it's too expensive, we can't, whatever. And some of the engine efficiency in Detroit occurred only because they were getting clobbered by foreign competition. And so then all of a sudden, well, you know, we can do this good, we can, and of course they can. They just need to push. But I'd suggest an answer to that question that the best thing we can do politically is have an agenda out there that the public can back. And then work with education. What you can do as a citizen, either get involved in politics or number two, try and promote education and political involvement. Because, and not a phony, something that's able to challenge the phony political environmentalism of much of the business community. Because I think you've got a role, I've got a role, we've all got a role if we care about the future.
One of my concerns, though, is the U.S. Supreme Court and what role they have in it. And there seems to be a majority of the justices for the last several years that have their own agenda going. And you know, one example is the takings issue, where you know, this property, they really believe, like you were saying, that you know, Joe Thompson, that's his property, he can do whatever he wants with it, and if he wants to buy this property in the floodplain and develop it, that's his right. And the community cannot not let him. And also, and you were talking about that show on PBS a while back on mm-hmm. corporate America, how they bind up American politics. Mm-hmm. And they were one of the guys on the show was talking about how the Supreme Court has ruled kind of two different ways on corporations. I can't quite remember the first, how in one case they're considered corporations and not as individuals. But in another instance, the Supreme Court has allowed them to be as individuals by supporting candidates.
Yeah, in the past, the Supreme Court had ruled much more that corporate free speech did not go to the extent of personal free speech. In recent years, they've been moving more, as you said, to saying that they have every right of free speech, which means, given the fact that they've got the money, they have more political clout than people do. I don't think that was the conception of founding fathers in terms of what corporations are. Let me respond to that quickly by saying I think the political system could get around that objection of the courts in many cases by limiting what we allow corporations to do. They're saying constitutionally, you can't say these corporations can't do this, but if we, in our corporate laws, say in order to get the privilege of incorporating and have limited liability and the other benefits you get from incorporating, you have these restrictions. Legislatively, we could get around a lot of it. And on the takings issue, I think you're right. That's a really big issue in terms of community ability to stop things that destroy our environment. One little example of that, and it shows that the political system is worse than the courts on this. In Minnesota, we've already had the billboard industry is around the country. They're one of the most effective politically involved businesses there are. They buy control of the political system like you wouldn't believe. I dropped in a bill this year that was going to repeal part of our amortization law, where we prohibit the state from compensating billboard owners by amortizing. If we decide that we effectively zone billboards out of roadside areas on our state highways and so on, under state law right now, 20 years ago, they went in there with a lot of clout and got the thing to say that if you want to compensate us for taking our billboards, you have to compensate it on these terms. You can't say that we'll allow you to keep your billboard in this illegal area for the next 5 years and use the money you get from that to pay for it. This is one case where the law says specifically, you cannot compensate us this way that others have used in the past. You can only compensate us this way. Well, this year, at the same time I dropped in my bill to try and ban billboards, which I think four states have done, we were going to not ban them, we were going to just put a moratorium on, a permanent moratorium, new ones. Do we have enough billboards? Too many? Not enough? I think most people would not say we have too few. there are a few who would, but not many. But on this one, the same week I dropped in that bill, the billboard industry got somebody coming in one and banning amortization from local governments. Why? Because there's St. Paul and several other communities were planning to ban billboards and they were going to do it through amortization. The courts in Minnesota have specifically allowed amortization as a concept as long as it's fair to the business, as long as they get their return out of their investment, as long as it's treating them fairly, as long as it's not an unconstitutional taking, which the Constitution does prohibit. And they've determined, you know, what's a taking and what's not. They've decided that that's fair. And the courts have allowed it. It's our legislative process with the pressure from the billboard industry that overruled what the courts have allowed. So why are the courts where they are? The legislative system is worse. Yes, sir.
I don't know much about the politics because I'm partially, I'm a Lutheran. So Lutheran taught two kingdoms.
Yes.
Secular and spiritual. So the my president of a seminary always told me, if you're going to improve politics, leave the seminary. That's what I have been taught.
Yes.
But in 1960s, President Eisenhower tried to come to my country.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, I was a freshman of the seminary. And that was the first time we Christian people organized demonstration protecting or asking not to come. At that time, I found even the missionaries said, don't go to politics.
Mm-hmm.
So, because some scared go went. So the but at the time we found no friends which we can speak to or communicate with outside of the country when we are facing crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So the right now I have friends, yes, sisters and brothers. So the first time I expressed my guilty feeling because our country produced transistor of tiny equipment making noisy around the world. Yes. And also the wasting materials.
Uh-huh.
We spend so much money. To host or to make a joy people. Mm-hmm. So that bubble was broken. And right now, in our Lutheran church in Japan, right now we are very serious situation because congregation and Japan Evangelical Lutheran Church decided to build the building, mm-hmm, including a generator in the basement, which was put, was asked to allow put the generator.
Mm-hmm.
That company operating atomic generation.
Mm-hmm.
So when our church decided to build or to accept generator underground of church building. It has nursing school too. So the controversy divided our church too. So we are kept away from politics. But right now, one of our pastor went to a congregation. Then a woman had equipment to measure radiation.
Okay.
Say, then she went to search radiation influence to personage. Then she measured all very high danger. So that congregation decided pastor don't need to stay in the personage.
Yeah.
It's going to be very crucial controversy because we are asking every pastor should stay in the personage.
Yeah.
Personage. Because our ministry is depend on such a system.
Yeah.
Even though each pastors and the families have a political attitude, but the pastors and the pastors' families should stay personage. But this lady or that pastor went to that congregation. He's saying we are going to search every personage. How much radiation?
How much radiation? Yeah.
And then I'm the president of Lutheran ministry, national. So then I'm very responsible person. Then what's going to? So the last thing. I'm sorry, I'm talking too much. But this is only time. So yes. So please, in 1977, Dr. Joe Cetra came to Coleraine to make a lecture. He didn't speak to our foreigners. He spoke to Lutheran pastors in Coleraine, and thinking about the pioneerism. When he said, my people, when said this is not comfortable, they could move to another place. And when they felt uncomfortable again, they moved to another place. But no more. No more. That's why we are facing common issues.
Yeah.
So finally, my question.
Okay.
We are studying Bible.
Okay.
Israel, even though they got the promised land, they never had their own land. Land belongs to the country or belongs to God. So they never kept property. So how are we going to think about that? Already money games is going on in this computerizing world. If it's going to someone speak, all lands where I'm going to belong to, I'm going to answer.
Where you belong to, and
You have control.
Okay.
United States keeps control.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the Russian officer gave data how Soviet submarines, atomic submarines, already destroying and making pollutions.
Mm-hmm.
He was arrested. He was guilty. So when we are going to think about environment, global environment, we are going to be face such a crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's...
Okay, well, let me comment a couple of them, and we got to close in about a minute or two, so I'll continue on afterwards and try to touch on some of your things. First of all, I do think understanding the concept of two kingdoms and so on, nevertheless, in a democracy, are to be involved, and as Christians, we are to live out our religious faith in all we do, and so I guess I think I have a problem if the church is taking over the political world and speaking as a church, vote for so-and-so or this position or that, but I do think the Bible very clearly tells us our concerns. We ought to be stewards of the earth. We should not destroy it. I think there are lots of issues and values we can gain from our faith that we can use politically. I agree the church should not be, other than speaking to those concerns, it should be extremely cautious about picking sides in political debates. But in terms of your other issue, I was going to say your comments about in Israel, the promised land, and whose land is it? It's not their land. I think that's a very strong biblical concept that everything we have is not ours, and for all our human concepts of ownership, my house, it's something I own. Well, do I own it? And do I own it 100 years from now? I won't be here 100 years from now. We should have a better biblical understanding of whose land, whose resources things are. And I'm not sure I quite caught all the things about the situation with the radiation. But I think the churches have to speak out in terms of setting an example, expressing concern about letting the planet get destroyed because we don't want to be involved politically is not it. And I think what you're mentioning, I didn't quite catch the reference to Soviet nuclear subs. One or two of them are on the bottom of the ocean, and what happens when the reactors in them release stuff. What I do, and it was somebody, your comment about the takings and what's private property and what do you have rights to do and so on. What I do, I could destroy life for millions of people by my outrageous behavior nowadays. I mean, one person may not be millions, it may be thousands of people. Of future generations, it could be millions if we do certain things. There are enough toxics, mercury, how small of an amount you need to contaminate a massive water supply. One person can destroy a tremendous amount, and one business or a whole culture that we have, you can destroy a lot, and we better speak out some way or another to recognize this is our planet. We're a common global community, and we better recognize it. With that, I think I'm overdue by about 7 or 8 minutes now, so I think I better call this to a formal close, though I'll be around for a few minutes and we can just continue the discussion if you'd like. So thank you very much for your attention, and hope this helps stimulate some thinking and I hope eventually action to change our lack of concern about our environment. So thank you. Right, yeah. Be politically involved, right?